Discourses on Daniel, the Interpreter of Dreams by Mary M. Bodie. Surely the Lord God will do nothing, but he revealeth his secrets unto his servants the prophets. Amos 3, verse 7. Preface. The following interesting interpretation of the prophecy of Daniel has been in print a number of years. This is the third edition of the book. We trust that it will continue to prove a blessing to hungry hearts and that the readers thereof will be built up spiritually and roused to fervent zeal for God and encouraged to look for the speedy coming of Jesus and hence run for the prize. The Bible student will discover sparkling nuggets of prophetic truth. It was given to Daniel to write, "None of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand." Daniel 12, verse 10. The wise are those who have oil in their vessels with their lamps. Matthew 25, 4. That is, they are filled with the Spirit as well as with the Word of God, and thus they understand. We bespeak for these lessons in this wonderful prophetic book a careful and unprejudiced reading and study, and we know that everyone so doing shall be blessed. The God of Daniel will thus be glorified even as his people are edified in view of the glorious consummation. The Publishers, 1952. Divisions in the Book of Daniel. The Book of Daniel falls easily into two divisions. Division 1, Gentile World Powers, External View, Daniel chapters 1 through 6, and Division 2, Gentile World Powers, Internal View, Daniel chapters 7 through 12. The first division relates altogether to the Gentile World Powers, their failure in ruling and judgment of God upon them. It was written in the Chaldean language as pertaining especially to the nations. It is an external view that is given as man sees the nations. At the end of the first division, we have these words again repeated. Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Daniel 6, verse 28. The second division gives us an internal view. It is of special interest to the Jew or those who are concerned with the things of God. This part was written in the Hebrew language, which we consider a most pregnant fact, for these six chapters are of a special moment to God's ancient people, the Jews. At the end of the second division, we find these comforting words to Daniel, "But go thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days." Daniel 12, verse 13. Introduction. Daniel is the prophet of the times of the Gentiles, though viewing them from the standpoint of the Jew. The phrase, times of the Gentiles, signifies that they have dominion for a certain period. It was sovereignly given to them by Jehovah. The term is used in contrast with the times of the Jews. The Jews are the chosen people of God. Nationally and religiously, they represent him upon the earth. He brought them out of Egypt and planted them in Palestine that they might be a witness to him in the middle of the earth. He gave them laws and bylaws, while even their physical daily life was regulated and directed by his commandments. The fruitfulness of the land and their permanency in it was conditioned upon their obedience to him. They were to hold their possessions in subjection to the Lord, being continually dependent upon him. But they failed in their allegiance. They sought unto Egypt in their trouble and gradually lost their fear of Jehovah and their gratitude for his goodness. Isaiah, one of the pre-exile prophets, witnessed again and again of the dire judgments which were about to fall upon them unless they would repent. But they stiffened their necks, hardened their hearts, and refused the admonitions. The word of prophecy fell upon dull ears. They continued in their disobedience, independence, and rebellion until finally his words by the prophets were fulfilled. According to secular chronology, in 740 BC, the 10 tribes, in scripture they are called Ephraim or Israel, were carried into Assyria, see 2 Kings 17. The sins for which judgment fell upon them are enumerated. They walked in the ways of the heathen, setting up groves and burning incense to other so-called gods, fearing them instead of fearing Jehovah, the true and living God. These 10 tribes have never been regathered nor restored to their place in the land. Hosea chapter 6, verses 1 through 2. In mercy, Jehovah went on dealing with Judah, as the two remaining tribes were called, for probably the space of 135 years after Israel had been scattered. But they finally became so incorrigible that he sent them out of the land for 70 years and gave the domination of the earth to the Gentiles. It is at the beginning of this prophetic period that Daniel takes his place upon the stage. In the first deportation of the captives of Judah, Daniel was taken down to Babylon, 606 BC. See Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 through 6. Jeremiah came on the scene 60 years after Isaiah and just previous to Daniel. He declared the 70-year captivity of Judah. His prophecy concerning their servitude as well as that of other nations to Nebuchadnezzar is wonderful. Jeremiah chapter 27. He literally acted out the subjection of Judah by wearing upon his neck a yoke first of wood and then of iron. He is called the weeping prophet, for the tears ran down his cheeks like streams because of the disobedience of the people and the judgment which he knew was sure to follow. He believed God. His prophecy and preaching were not a theory to him. He was assured that he was the mouthpiece of Jehovah. Therefore, the words which he was speaking would come to pass. It makes men different to believe God. Faith creates characters such as these men, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, etc. It was in the first year of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, that Jeremiah commenced his prophecy concerning the world's sovereignty passing in the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. But it was not until the third year of his reign that the king of Judah actually was made subject to the king of Babylon. Jeremiah continued to prophesy during Jehoiakim's short reign of 3 months and through the 11 years that Zedekiah sat upon the throne, 2 Kings 24. The latter is most significant. It plainly denotes that Judah's captivity took place in relays or stages. For if it became an accomplished fact in Jehoiakim's day, why should the prophet continue to urge the people to yield to the inevitable and submit to the king of Babylon? Judah's carrying away occurred in stages covering a period of 19 years. Likewise, we should expect a corresponding gradation in their deliverance at the end time. As the beginning of the times of the Gentiles covered a period of time, we should so judge their close will embrace a similar period. Furthermore, as the last king of Judah, Zedekiah insisted upon holding the dominion in defiance of Jehovah's edict that he had given it to Nebuchadnezzar. So will it be in the case of the Gentiles. They too will insist on holding the reins of government. The last king, like Zedekiah, will be a usurper. Division 1, Gentile World Powers, External View. Daniel chapters 1 through 6. Daniel, a captive in Babylon. Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem, and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, the house of his God. Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Have you noticed how many of God's prophets were captives? It seems to be a special mark of favor. Paul was a captive. Ezekiel, as well as Daniel, was carried down a captive to Babylon. Jehoiakim reigned 3 years before Nebuchadnezzar besieged the city and took some of the people captive. This important event transpired in 607 BC. The exact date was formerly considered a doubtful question, but need not be so now, since the marvelous happenings of the past few years and their striking relation to the Jews, we are sure of the year of this first invasion. It marked the beginning of the 70-year captivity of Judah in Babylon, though it was only a partial bondage. Nebuchadnezzar bound Jehoiakim in fetters, presumably to carry him to Babylon, 2 Chronicles 36:6. But later he was released and given the throne again, only as subject to the king of Babylon. It was at this time that Daniel was taken captive. He must have been quite young, for he was still hale and hearty and a great man of affairs in Babylon after the 70-year captivity had expired. There were 3 other Jewish boys of the royal house of David taken captive at that same time. This was all in fulfillment of the prophecy of Isaiah 120 years previous, referring to Hezekiah, king of Judah, who was of the lineage of David. Behold, the days come that all that is in thy house shall be carried to Babylon, and of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Isaiah 39:7-8. These young men were the choicest of this chosen line and taken captive in the first siege. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, commanded Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, to select certain of the king's seed, princes of Judah, the very best to be found. These were made eunuchs, sterile, unfruitful as regards the natural man. He wanted the wisdom and beauty of Judah to enhance his kingdom, but he did not desire to perpetuate the royal seed as it might jeopardize his throne. These 4 young princes were children in whom there was no blemish, for so were the instructions, Daniel chapter 1, verse 4. They must be well-favored and skillful in all wisdom, cunning in knowledge, and understanding science. Further, they must have ability or right as the king's seed to stand in the king's palace. Nebuchadnezzar considered that he was conferring a high honor upon these young men by his selection of them as dignitaries of his court. But the real fact of the matter was that he was honored by their presence in Babylon. They were the flower of Judean fruit. The king of Babylon desired the choicest specimen of David's line. He wanted his kingdom to be beautified and made prominent in every respect by the spoils of his conquest of Judah. So it was. There were none comelier among all his court than these royal sons of Judah. They proved not only their kinship to David and his house, but their kinship to heaven, which is the better. The master of the eunuchs changed the names of these Jewish captives, giving them Babylonish names. He did not want to be reminded of God. Daniel, God is judge, becomes Belteshazzar, Lord of the straitened treasure. Hananiah, the grace of Yah, is called Shadrach, the breast was tender. Mishael, who is what God is known as Meshach, who is what thou art. Azariah, helped of Jehovah, finds the much less beautiful name of Abednego, servant of brightness. In some measure, Nebuchadnezzar appears cognizant of God's plans as to his sovereignty. He, as well as Daniel, was a chosen vessel for an appointed time. God had already prepared him as the instrument in his hand for the chastisement of his people Judah. His father, Nabopolassar, conquered Nineveh and brought down the pride of the capital city of the Assyrian Empire. Even then, while Nebuchadnezzar was only the heir apparent to the throne, yet he established a record as a conqueror. In fact, according to Jeremiah 25:1, he was not yet seated upon the throne when he made his first siege against Jerusalem. Compare Jeremiah 25:1 with Daniel 1:1. Even then, he was the man of the hour. God gave him that honor. Daniel's great decision. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Daniel chapter 1, verse 8. The above scripture gives us the key to Daniel's life and shows us that he was a prepared, yea, a chosen vessel of Jehovah. At the outset, his conduct marks him as one whose life was already modeled by the will of God. He passed through the gates of the new capital of the world with purpose of heart. His decision of character is amazing in one so young. No foolish earthly ambitions to excel in the Babylonish court entered his mind. He was altogether and only interested in Jehovah and his interests. Remember, he was a prince in the dawn of his youth, entering new scenes where there was every prospect and worldly inducement to tempt him from the memories of his childhood days and his moral upbringing. It was a sudden and violent contrast to his former manner of living and marked a critical epoch in his life. However, the difference in the moral and political surroundings and influences into which he was cast only served to root his faith deeper in the God of his fathers and their national and religious hope. Daniel was no weakling, as the record here assures. He did not drift with the tide, but stood and dammed the current of the times in which he lived for others of that day. At the risk of losing not only every hope of worldly advancement, but more, bringing down upon himself the dreadful anger and vengeance of the absolute monarch of the world, he decided that though he was obliged to live in the worldly court of Babylon, he would not be of it. Oh, what a lesson of abnegation and sacrifice! What an example of loyalty to Jehovah! This was not a purpose formed in a moment. Oh no, it simply portrays the young man's attitude of heart. His heart was fixed, unwavering in its faithfulness to God. He lived and walked with him. He knew his God. Observe further that Daniel made this decision, settled it in his own heart, before he mentioned the matter to the prince in charge. No doubt, the critical time in which he lived had much to do with his purpose to forego all the pleasures and stimulating influences of Babylon, which the eating and drinking represents. He was simply carrying out in practical life the rules afterward laid down by the overcomer Paul, which he himself practiced. I keep under my body and bring it into subjection. 1 Corinthians 9:27. He made his body serve him and thus was a vessel meet and sanctified for the master's use. 1 Timothy 2:21. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. Daniel 1 verse 9. Daniel was a favorite, we would say, and he takes advantage of the situation to request permission to choose his own bill of fare. What we eat and how we eat has often much to do with our spiritual growth. There is an overindulgence in the matter of food as well as strong drink. An inordinate appetite for food should be conquered as well as other inordinate desires. If we give ourselves up to any craving of the body is not then brought under, but rather the opposite. We are overcome, and God cannot use such folks in his greater projects. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat of the king's meat, and as thou seest, deal with thy servants. Daniel chapter 1, verses 11 through 13. Daniel was not afraid of the result. After a test of 10 days, Daniel was willing to let the one in charge decide the matter. He knew that his God would prove faithful. Daniel believed in healing. Yea, more, he believed in divine health. His fare was poor compared with the menu of the king's table, but the outcome is marvelous. Melzar consented to the trial. He took away the portion of the meat and the wine that they should drink and gave them pulse according to their desire. At the end of the 10 days, they were fairer and fatter than all the others who had fed on Babylon's fare. Naturally, they would have been glad for such food, but they were believing God, and therefore it was refused. It was connected with the false gods of Babylon being a part of the fare of an idolatrous king. The law of God was stringent as to separation between things clean and unclean, and as a Jew, Daniel was under its obligations. A lesser character would have let down, succumbed to the temptation, easing his conscience by the plea that he was a slave there and could not help himself. Or he might have gone a step further and argued that God had allowed his captivity and he had to obey the king of Babylon now rather than Jehovah. We are apt to find good reasons for doing what we want to do, but Daniel really wanted to please God. The Lord knew his servant and answered his faith. They were spared further trouble on that score. Notice the sequel. As for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. Daniel 1, verse 17a. This was in natural things, but not in a natural way, nor by natural means. It was supernatural wisdom and understanding that put all the skill of the natural man to blush. It appears to me that God is gifting some of these sons of Judah today in a remarkable manner, though we cannot say they know their God as did Daniel. Yet it is amazing what they are doing in the world and how the greatest men in every walk of life have to acknowledge the genius and skill of the Jew. Take, for instance, Dr. Chaim Weizmann, the noted English chemist whose great discovery cost England the land of Palestine. He would take nothing less and nothing else as his reward. It was God that gave him the skill and understanding, for his discovery was used to bring some of his ordained purposes to pass. Likewise, in Babylon's court and before Nebuchadnezzar, the wisdom of these Jewish boys was not alone a matter of comment, but of real practical value to the land of their captivity. Daniel, however, had added gifts, spiritual gifts, for we read, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Daniel 1:17b. This qualified him as the leader among the other equally faithful Hebrew boys. He was endued above his fellows for a special purpose and for a special time. God wanted him to shine in Babylon as his representative, and he got him there. Daniel was a worthy one. No fault was found in him. He easily carried off the honors in every way. His testimony unshakable, his faithfulness unchangeable, his word unimpeachable, his skill and understanding supreme. Morally, intellectually, and spiritually, he towered above them all because he was a figure, a witness, a sign. After the years of their training had expired, when they had finished their course of study, as we would say, Daniel and his three companions were presented before Nebuchadnezzar for their examination. He found none like them. They excelled above all other candidates. Nebuchadnezzar was so impressed with Daniel's superiority that he made him minister of his royal court. Later, he was promoted to higher honor, sitting as a ruler and a judge over the whole province of Babylon. Daniel 2, verse 48. He was preferred above the chief men and the wise men of the kingdom. Furthermore, he not only served during the 44-year reign of Nebuchadnezzar, but also the other Babylonish monarchs. And he continued in high honor under the succeeding Medo-Persian dynasty. Therefore, we see that Daniel's official career spanned the whole 70 years of Judah's captivity in Babylon. He was a witness for God there, a witness to the truth of his word and its positive fulfillment. We read, Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. He was, no doubt, an effective agent in the hand of God at that time, for the restoration of the captivity began in the first year of the Persian Empire. Daniel knew the times were at hand. He read Jeremiah's prediction concerning the 70 years of the desolations of Jerusalem, Daniel 9, verse 2. From the prophet Isaiah, he learned even the name of the man who should be the instrument of Judah's release, Isaiah 44, verse 28, and Isaiah 45, verses 1 through 6. He no doubt instructed Cyrus relative to God's will concerning his part in the drama that was then about to be enacted. He must have also shown him the prophecy of Jeremiah with the definite time fixed for the termination of the captivity which had just expired, as Cyrus took the throne in 536 BC. Without doubt, all this influenced the Persian king to issue the decree which began the release of the exiles, 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verses 22 and 23. The sovereignty of God is shown in this book in greater manifestation than in any other book of the Bible. We are surely amazed to see the positive evidence that the heavens do rule, Daniel 4, verse 6. This very first chapter is a table of contents to the whole of the book. It begins with Daniel and Judah's captivity and ends with their release. See last verse of the chapter. Daniel himself appears to be a figure of the Jews in some sense and a figure of the Jew, Christ Jesus, in another. He is a marvelous character, standing out in vivid relief because of his contrast with others. An overcomer, strenuous, energetic, abstemious, in the midst of luxury, unbelief, worldliness, in the midst of everything that is against God, he stood for God, a witness, even as his words of prophecy, shining the brighter because of the darkness. We have now had an introduction to the man of our book, Daniel. We are somewhat acquainted with him and his times. Because the influences which molded his character and the providences which changed his career and fitted him for his destiny are no longer a secret to us, we are the more intelligently prepared for the marvelous revelations which follow in his prophecies. According to the man, so are his writings. The Great Image, Daniel chapter 2. And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep went from him. Daniel 2, verse 1. The above-noted event happened to the king in 603 B.C., which was 3 years after Daniel was taken to Babylon, and 2 years after Nebuchadnezzar had come to the throne of the Chaldeans, 605 B.C., see Jeremiah 25, 1. As we said in our study of Daniel 1, Nebuchadnezzar was not yet seated on the throne when he made his first siege against Jerusalem. At the time of this dream, Daniel was already numbered among the wise men of Babylon, having passed a successful examination and received his credentials. The king commanded that the magicians, astrologers, sorcerers, and Chaldeans be called to show the king his dream. That is, they were required not only to interpret the dream, but more, they were required to tell the king his dream. It was such an unusual experience that a man should have a dream so wonderful and peculiar, which left such a strange, ineffaceable impression upon his mind, and yet he could not remember the dream. It is not difficult to understand that he wanted the interpretation of it all. The wise men were in a quandary. They answered the king, "There is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. It is a rare thing that the king requireth, and there is none that can show it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with men." Daniel 2, verses 10 through 11. The wisdom of the soothsayers, sorcerers, astrologers, etc., is taxed to the uttermost. Their magic arts are of no avail to fathom this mystery. They say to the king, "You have asked a hard thing. No one has ever been required to tell a dream. It is difficult enough to interpret a dream when it is known. No ruler before ever made such a demand." They are indignant at the unreasonableness of the matter, and they voice their sentiments. It is impossible, they argue, to do as the king requires, because only the gods, whose dwelling is not with men, is able to show the king his dream and give the interpretation. Thus, they virtually acknowledge the defeat of the wisdom of the world. There is a limit to their arts. They also admit a higher wisdom which alone is able to cope with such a problem. They point Nebuchadnezzar to the supernatural. For this cause the king was angry and very furious. He commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon, and the decree went forth, and they sought Daniel and his fellows that they should be slain. Daniel 2, verses 12 and 13. By the edict of God, Nebuchadnezzar was the sovereign of the world. Though he never did take possession of the earth in its entirety, nevertheless the dominion belonged to him. He was now simply showing his absolute authority in commanding those wise men of his realm to be put to death. Daniel and his fellows were included in that wholesale slaughter, though, as it appears, they knew nothing whatever of the circumstances. They had not even been given a chance to tell the dream and interpret it. They were in ignorance of their peril until the king's guard went forth to slay them. But God was in it all. He not only allowed the procedure on the part of Nebuchadnezzar, but he ordered it. Nebuchadnezzar was a great sovereign, but yet he was only a little atom in the hand of the sovereign. He gave the king that dream, which was afterwards not remembered and which none of his wise men could interpret, for he desired that Daniel and his three fellows be given the place in Babylon's court which he had purposed for them. They were to be honored above all the wise men of the world because they represented the heavenly throne and the divine wisdom which rules over the earthly throne and worldly wisdom. And God was making Nebuchadnezzar acknowledge this fact. Daniel inquires of Arioch, the captain of the king's guard. Then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree so hasty from the king?" Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. Then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. Daniel chapter 2, verses 14 through 16. What faith, what assurance! Yea, what confidence Daniel exhibits, yet it is not confidence in himself, but in his God. He knew that he was chosen of Jehovah to represent him in Babylon. Hence, he could not be destroyed. There must be a way out, he argued. But this assurance did not lead to listlessness or indifference. No, indeed. He went in first to the earthly king, and then he went in to the great heavenly sovereign. Then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel 2, verses 17 through 19. He went to his own house and made the thing known to his companions, and they prayed. Do you see how we find out secrets? We find out secrets by waiting on God. Even now, prayer opens up deep mysteries to us. Daniel's God is our God. They went in unto God, who never has no admittance on his door, but always at home. Daniel prayed to the God of heaven. This is significant. It is his name in this book of Daniel. He is no longer the God of earth. He has taken away his presence from the children of Israel and cast them out of their land. So he was known to Daniel as the God of heaven. The Gentiles were not his people. He is allowing them to have dominion for a limited time that they may learn how little fitted they are to rule for him. For always the lower kingdom must be subject to the higher. The Gentiles will have to acknowledge that they were no more obedient to God than the Jews. He has given them a chance that they may know they are not able to rule the world. For the man who rules the world must first rule himself. Jesus Christ is the only man that did so. He is God's ruler. He was proved in this world and was found faultless, walking in dependence upon God every step of the way. He honored God to the uttermost. Observe that Daniel does not only praise God for the personal deliverance he and his fellows received, but his heart is bursting with praise to the God of heaven for the wondrous revelation that was vouchsafed to him. Daniel blessed the God of heaven. He is overwhelmed with the magnitude of God's sovereign dealings with all the nations of the world. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. He changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and he setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom to the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. Daniel 2, verses 20 and 21. Although Daniel may not have understood the length of time which was figured by the symbolic image which Nebuchadnezzar saw, he was given to know the dream and its interpretation. He himself is the proof of his words here as to God's ways with men, giving wisdom to the wise and knowledge to men of understanding. Daniel exemplified both. For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. Matthew 25, verse 29. He had known some things, and now he learns some more. He learns that God had changed the times from Jewish to Gentile, and that the seasons were also being changed. He learns that it was God who had removed the kings of Judah and had given dominion to Nebuchadnezzar, and that he would continue to remove kings and give the dominion to whom he pleases. All this, I say, Daniel had learned, and he glorified God for his sovereignty over the nations. He was shown that Jehovah is indeed the God of heaven, and we are taught later in this book that the heavens do rule, Daniel chapter 4, verse 26, though to many this is superstition. Daniel was wise and was growing wiser every day in every way. He was given to see that Nebuchadnezzar's dream and its interpretation was simply a disclosure of Jehovah's vast foreordained purposes for the nations of the earth. He was revealing these facts before they came to pass that men might believe that he is God and that there is no other God. He calls attention to fulfilled prophecy as the greatest evidence of the truth of the Bible. See Isaiah 41, verse 22. Out of the multitude of books of all lands and all ages, the Bible is unique in that it is the only record of genuine prophecy in the world. Christ based his claims upon the correctness of his prophetic utterance. John chapter 13, verse 16. On this line, the book of Daniel is a book of marvels. So many of its prophecies are now history that the critics would like to take it out of the Bible, or at least prove that it was written after the things of which it tells before had come to pass. They put them to shame because they have been so literally and perfectly fulfilled. The very image Nebuchadnezzar was so insistent to get the interpretation of is prophecy in symbol, as we learn first from the interpretation and later from history. Jehovah reveals these deep and hidden things to men so that when they come to pass, they may fear him and acknowledge his power and wisdom. He knows that man can never search them out, for his intellect is in darkness. He is ignorant as regards God's things. Therefore, man must come to him, as did Daniel, for the interpretation of his dreams and the solving of questions. Daniel went in unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon, and informed him that he could now satisfy the king's demands as to his dream and its interpretation. He says, "Destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me before the king." Arioch seemed only too glad to be relieved of the slaughter of the wise men. He gladly availed himself of the way of escape and brought Daniel into the presence of the king in haste, saying, "I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation." Daniel 2, verse 25. What a blow to all the vaunted wisdom of the world! They can never understand God or his purposes. It was revealed to a captive of Judah, as Arioch was made to say to the king. Daniel is the real sovereign in this scene. Nebuchadnezzar is a suppliant at his feet. He is dependent upon him to understand the things which are coming to pass upon the earth. He eagerly questions Daniel. "Art thou able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof?" Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king hath demanded cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers show unto the king. But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and makes known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days." Daniel 2, verses 26 through 28. Here is where Daniel steps upon the scene as a prophet. I say he is the king, though disguised, it is true. He boldly informs Nebuchadnezzar that none of the wise men of this realm are able to interpret his dream. Furthermore, he adds that the king is indebted to Daniel's God for the interpretation of these things, symbolized by the image, which shall come to pass in the latter days. Observe the emphasis upon the time of the fulfillment of the dream. It points especially to a future consummation. These latter days must be viewed in relation to the things concerning the times of the Gentiles. Nebuchadnezzar's first invasion of the land of Judah not only was the beginning of the 70 years of Babylonish captivity, but it also introduced the long and not yet ended domination of the Gentiles. While the dream and the interpretation compassed the whole Gentile times, yet God would make known to Nebuchadnezzar, who stands as the representative of all Gentile world powers, what shall befall them at the end. The Forgotten Dream. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed, what shall come to pass hereafter. Thou, O king, sawest and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet, which were of iron and clay, and broke them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floor, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them, and the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Daniel 2, verse 29 and 31 through 35. I have quoted quite at length that we may get the dream just as though Daniel was telling it to us today. For we are living in the very time upon which the revelation is especially focused. The dream was marvelous, not only because of its prophetic character, but simply marvelous to behold. It was an awe-inspiring sight, a majestic, shining, colossal figure standing upright before Nebuchadnezzar, until a stone coming suddenly from the mountain falls upon the feet and the image disappears. It is enough to make anyone wonder and seek the solution. Nebuchadnezzar no doubt recalls the dream as soon as Daniel begins his description, revealing the image in successive stages from his head to his feet. But it is the latter section, the feet, upon which he rivets the king's attention. It is upon these that the stone falls, not upon the whole figure, though the entire image is therewith demolished. As it is the latter day phase of the image that Daniel informs the king is important, we may rightly infer that the combination of the iron and clay, which is found in the feet, two radically differing elements, is a sign of the latter days. Finally, the climax consists in the catastrophe which happens to the image when the stone falls upon it, and the resultant metamorphosis of the stone, the image being destroyed, the stone becoming a great mountain filling the earth. Nebuchadnezzar must have been impressed indeed as Daniel proceeded with the description of his dream. He must have realized its import in some measure even before the prophet gave the interpretation. For it is plainly evident that God gave this dream to Nebuchadnezzar, that he, as well as other Gentile rulers, might know that their supremacy is but for a time, limited and controlled by the God of heaven, and that the end of their earthly rule would come through being smitten by a supernatural power and by the setting up in its place of another kingdom of an entirely different character and origin. We are impressed at this moment with the significance of Nebuchadnezzar forgetting his dream. He stands here as representative of all Gentile rulers, and it is in this capacity that he fails to recollect the vision of the night. He will not remember the fiat of the God of Daniel, that their tenure of office is but for a limited time. God reserves to himself the right to withdraw the sovereignty of the earth from them at any moment. He has given it to them at his own good pleasure. He will take it away in like manner. The prophets have declared over and over this fact to the kings of the earth, but they, like Nebuchadnezzar, forget the dream and its interpretation. They will refuse to abdicate in favor of God's man when his hour has come. The interpretation of the dream. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. Wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of heaven hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. Forasmuch as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron shall break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of the potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it the strength of the iron, forasmuch as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to the other, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. But it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Forasmuch as thou sawest until a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, The great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. Daniel chapter 2, verses 37 through 45. The latter part of verse 38, "Thou art this head of gold," gives us the first striking feature of the image and the key to its interpretation. It symbolizes the four world empires, of which Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, Babylon, was the first. The names of the other three are easily found now, for the prophecy of this massive metallic symbol has now almost become history. But I want to emphasize the fact that even without secular history, where we are at no loss to know the names of the other three, we need go no further than this book of Daniel for the greater part of the information. In Daniel 5:28, we read these words given to Belshazzar, the last Babylonish emperor: "Peres, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians." Here is the second empire, answering to the breasts and arms of silver on the image. The Medo-Persian dynasty succeeded the Babylonish Empire about 536 BC. This happened just in the order and time as was prophesied by Jeremiah relating to Nebuchadnezzar. "All nations shall serve him and his son and his son's son until the very time of his land come." Jeremiah 27, verse 7. Again, we may find the name of the third kingdom symbolized by the belly and thighs of brass depicted and named in Daniel 8:5. There, we are informed that the united Medes and Persians would be succeeded by the Grecian Empire with its fourfold division at Alexander's death, Daniel 8, verses 20 and 21. In this latter kingdom was introduced a feature which was not in the other two. It was to bear rule over all the earth. That world conquest was literally fulfilled in the career of Alexander the Great, the first king of the Third Empire. For while Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus were conquerors, it remained for Alexander to put them in the shade. In the course of a few years, he overran the whole of the then known world. In fact, history records that he is the general who wept because he had no more worlds to conquer, as though he had really taken possession of the earth. The kingdom of Greece came into being 328 BC. The next question, does Daniel interpret the fourth kingdom for us? May be truly answered, yes, he does, though not quite so explicitly as in the other three cases, but the answer is in the Word of God. In Luke chapter 1, verse 1, we hear of another great empire which had world dominion. "And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed." Here is the fourth kingdom. The word assures us that it was universal, for it summoned men from the four corners of the earth to be enrolled as its subjects. It is the answer to the legs of iron upon the image. We learn from history that this was the Roman Empire. It crushed the power of Greece and extended its dominion over all Asia. It was the strongest empire in a sense, as Daniel informs us. "The fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, forasmuch as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron shall it break in pieces and bruise." The Roman Empire succeeded the Grecian Empire in 61 BC and was divided into two spheres, the eastern and western, ruled over by one king, depicted by the two legs and feet upon the image. It should be noted here that the Grecian Empire was rapidly declining in 60 BC, but the Roman Empire, although it was gaining in national prowess before, was not really launched until 31 BC. It remained in this divided condition for years, but Daniel tells us that this same empire, renowned for its amazing strength, is to be an exhibition of the greatest weakness. The compactness, solidity, and strength of an absolute monarch is sadly disrupted by the tenfold partition seen in the toes upon the image. These latter are said to be part of iron and part of clay. The iron was the original element. It is a metal, while the clay is another element altogether. It does not properly belong to the image, but we are thus taught the deterioration that would be manifest in Gentile rule, deterioration in governmental quality, as well as in amalgamation. The deterioration is seen in the succession of silver to gold, brass to silver, iron to brass, and the amalgamation is evidenced by the dual breast and arms representing the dual empire of the Medes and Persians, in contrast with that of the Babylonish Empire represented by the head of gold. While the deterioration manifest in the fourfold partition of the Grecian Empire is not depicted by the image, yet in the Roman Empire it is plainly marked by the division of the two legs. But both these characteristics, or weaknesses, governmental and cohesive, are greatly exaggerated in the last phase of the Fourth Empire, represented by the feet and toes. These constitute the latter days of the times of the Gentiles, the history which the symbol images. This phase of the image, feet and toes, was most remote at the time of the vision, but note that the prediction regarding them is the more detailed. Therefore, we are to rivet our attention upon them. These represent the last nations of the Roman Empire, the present nations of the world, who will shortly coalesce under one head. At the beginning of Gentile times, the imperial form of government was most absolute, as seen in Nebuchadnezzar's reign, and that continued with varying degrees of deterioration manifest in the succeeding three empires until the World War of 1914. At that time, there were great imperial monarchies in Europe, German, Russian, etc., which appeared invulnerable and commanded the attention of the world because of their iron rule. They were the remains of Imperial Rome. Note their rulers' titles, Kaiser, Tsar, etc., agreeing with that of Caesar. But where are they today? They are gone. The very remembrance of them is an offense among the nations. Who could have imagined such a catastrophe without the lamp of prophecy to light the way? The extremity has been reached. The end is here, as had been foreshadowed. The stone will soon fall, for the weakness manifest in the mixture of iron and clay is very apparent. What does this signify, someone may ask? The answer is given us by Daniel himself, the interpreter of the image. He says, "They shall mingle themselves with the seed of men." In the time of the end, the latter days, an unexpected form of government shall prevail, a form differing very radically from what has preceded. It will be a combination of imperialism with democracy, the kings with the people. They shall mingle, but there shall be no cohesion. They shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with miry clay. Here we are informed of an unheard-of combination, a union of contradictory elements. Remember that Daniel is describing the latter phase of the Fourth World Empire. He is telling Nebuchadnezzar and all the Gentile rulers the conditions which will obtain way down to the end of their times. He says that in the final government there will be no real union or harmony. Historically, we are living in the days to which the feet on the image point, but we have not yet arrived at the last days of the toes. We see the shadow in the distance. It is marvelous to contemplate the wisdom shown in the structure of the dream image. The very fact that the legs gave way to the feet and yet are counted as one kingdom is amazing when the prophecy is understood. The two advents of Christ, emperor of the Fifth World Empire, are compassed in these two phases of the Fourth World Kingdom. First, Christ came when the Roman Empire was in its infancy. The iron legs stage of the image was in its beginning. Second, at his second advent, the Roman Empire will be in its end. The clay and iron feet stage will be in evidence. The latter must precede the setting up of Christ's kingdom. It forms the necessary background for his marvelous lightning-like appearing. Many prophesied during the late war that its close would reveal the complete collapse of imperial rule and the triumph of the populace, but such is not the case nor ever shall be. The Book of Books does not so instruct us. Nebuchadnezzar's prophetic dream, as well as manifold other scriptures, forbid such a conclusion. These irreconcilable conditions, monarch linked up with democracy, as to world rulership, is the expected consummation of the age. These hostile elements will be in apparent harmony for a specified time. We are not yet in the last day period of the toes, but the structural formation of the feet is surely before our eyes. Many almost see the joints and ligaments coming together into place for the building together of the last gigantic world empire of the times of the Gentiles. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Daniel 2:44. This verse gives us the key to the whole purpose of the dream. God desired Nebuchadnezzar, as well as future Gentile lords, to know that their times as rulers on earth would be superseded by another form of government. This appears to be the one great object of all the revelations of this book of Daniel. The God of heaven would have men realize that he is Lord over his own universe, and that they cannot rule him off in their calculations, nor expect him to acquiesce in their plans and purposes for this little earth ball. He has his own blueprint designed for this planet, which antedates that of man by some thousands of years. He himself intends to set up a kingdom with the king of his choice at the helm. It will be a heavenly kingdom. The heavens will truly rule then, not invisibly as at the present time, but the fact will be manifest. Righteousness, justice, and judgment will be actualized upon the earth. Furthermore, the revelations given in this book, though they proceed from the standpoint of Gentile supremacy over Israel, all focus upon this period, remote when they were given, the last days of that dominion. They insist upon the rise of Israel from her degradation into exaltation and preeminence as the people of God and his channel of blessing to the world. The description of the beginning of their kingdom is peculiar and astonishing. A stone falls from heaven, torn away from the battlements of glory, not by human hands, but by divine power, and strikes the great image upon the feet. The amazing result, the image disappears. Herein we are given a vivid representation of the earthly powers prospering and progressing, until in a moment a great catastrophe is manifest. An unlikely power, a supernatural something, has made its appearance. Suddenly, without any warning apparently, though prophecy has declared it, the great image which had appeared invulnerable is reduced to nothingness by the little stone. Then note the marvelous transformation and development of the stone. It becomes a great mountain and fills the whole earth. The figure is beautiful and so perfectly in harmony with Scripture when we consider the fact that a mountain in inspired language signifies a kingdom. We would therefore infer that Christ's kingdom and the Jews' exaltation, while comparatively limited in their beginnings, will shortly become universal in the earth. The supremacy will never be given to any other people. Israel will come into her own place as God's chosen nation, the head and not the tail, and she will never lose this honor. The stone of Israel, Genesis 49, the good shepherd who had given his life for the sheep will arrive in great haste to deliver the little believing remnant from the wolf, Antichrist, who will be tearing them to pieces. For the false hireling shepherd, false prophet, having sold out to his master, will flee and leave them to the destroyer. John chapter 10, verses 12 and 13. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel and commanded that they should offer up an oblation and sweet odors. And the king answered Daniel and said, "Of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of lords and a revealer of secrets." Daniel 2, verses 46 and 47. In the king's acknowledgement of Daniel's God, we have a hint of the Trinity, supreme God, supreme king, and revealer of secrets. Nebuchadnezzar is overwhelmed with the disclosures which have been vouchsafed to him. The result is to bring him to his knees in worship of the true and living God whom Daniel represented. Accordingly, he exalts the servant of such a great God and gives him many gifts and makes him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief of the governors of all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel 2:48. God desired Nebuchadnezzar to know and acknowledge the fact that he was the sovereign and that Nebuchadnezzar had been given his kingdom as subject to himself for a certain time. He revealed to Daniel, and thus to the king, that there was to be a restoration of Israel to their place of supremacy. The Gentiles have refused to acknowledge the Jews' place on God's program and their obligations and accountability to him for an appointed time. What terrible judgment awaits them when the King of the Jews, his title on the cross, arises to shake terribly the earth. Habakkuk the prophet gives us a vivid description of the mighty devastating power of Jehovah as he comes in fierce anger for the deliverance of his waiting people. He tells us, though he only saw the vision, that his body trembled and his lips quivered at the voice of the Lord. Rottenness entered into his bones as he viewed the majesty of the king in his coming advance against the usurping nations of the end of the age. Oh, how we should be like Daniel ourselves and seek to make the people know what shall be in the latter days. And Daniel requested of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. Daniel 2:49. A spiritual lesson. And there is another application of this dream image which we may plainly trace through the writings of the Apostle Paul. He gives us the key to this phase of the mystery when he says, "Howbeit, that was not first which was spiritual, but that which was natural." 1 Corinthians 15:46. The first man must have his opportunity in everything before the second man comes upon the scene. It was thus in the beginning. Adam was created first, but he was only a figure of Christ who was the ordained man before the world was made. Furthermore, there would never have been the creation of the natural man if the spiritual man had not been in view. In the case of the world empires, which were symbolized by the dream image, they would not have appeared upon the scene of this world if the kingdom of Christ was not to follow. Even these successive kingdoms are but figures of different spheres of authorities, principalities, and powers which shall be manifested in that rule of heaven upon the earth. The great man whom Nebuchadnezzar saw in vision is but a feeble representation of Christ and his body, the church seen in its full growth and perfection. The words, "Thou art this head of gold," said to Nebuchadnezzar, really apply to Christ, of whom he was a type. The other ranks in the kingdom are represented by the lesser grades, inferior metals, that are seen in the image. God had a great plan outlined for the ages before these times began. He, as the architect and builder, had a heavenly design marked out for the exaltation of the human family, but it necessitated a humbling first. Therefore, man's fall and full redemption is the working out of the scheme or plan of God. In his blueprint, he purposed that his son should reign over the earth, but as a man with a body of people over whom he should be head. It is this mystical Christ which shall be the ruler of the fifth world empire. The very number 5 is significant. It speaks of God and man joined together in an indissoluble union, one harmonic whole. The hand and foot of man is an expression of the power of such union. The 4 fingers and toes are inadequate and insufficient without the thumb or large toe. So man without God is weak and helpless. But with God, man is mighty. He can do all things. As a new creation, man is going to reign over the whole created universe of God. Already God has raised Christ up out of the dead ones, the earnest of the resurrection of his body, and seated him in the heavenlies. Far above all principality and power and might and dominion and every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in that which is to come, and hath subjected all things under his feet, and constituted him the head for that congregation, which is his body, the full development of him, the all things filling. Ephesians 1:20-23, Diaglot. Weymouth's translation of the last 2 verses here is beautiful. He says, God hath put all things under Christ's feet, and hath appointed him universal and supreme head of the church, which is his body, the completeness of him who everywhere fills the universe with himself. That is, the universe of God would be incomplete without his church. It is a wonderful mystery. God's plans demand a full-grown, perfected man to rule the heavens and the earth, and that man is still in process of development. Nebuchadnezzar was given a vision at the beginning of the times of the Gentiles, a symbol of this mighty, mystical, world-conquering man. But there had to come first that which was natural, the figure of the different spheres of glories of this marvelous kingdom of heaven had to first appear. These successive empires had to run their course, but the end is almost in sight now. The fifth world empire with its glorious new man ruler looms large in the distance. The times are about to change. Nebuchadnezzar's image, Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Daniel chapter 3, verse 1. In Daniel 2, we were shown God's sovereign dealings with the nations of the earth. Because of the failure of their kings to acknowledge his authority, God took the rulership away from Israel and gave the dominion into the hands of the Gentiles. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, was the first servant of this new order of things. He introduced the imperial system of government by the change. One ruler was thus the potentate of the world, its absolute ruler in every respect. Gentile times began in that manner, and they will end in the same way. But the latter world potentate will be a usurper. He will be entirely out of divine order, though the time will be ripe for the imperial form of government. But the wrong man will be in the saddle for a time. He will be a pretender, Satan's counterfeit of the true king, God's choice. It is this false ruler and his false worship that are most strikingly portrayed in our present chapter. The good effect made upon Nebuchadnezzar by Daniel's interpretation of his dream was short-lived. It moved him to acknowledge the God of heaven and his sovereignty regarding him and his kingdom, in that all power and authority were in his hands. But now we see him moved just as strenuously in another direction. He is rather puffed up than humbled by the marvelous disclosure of the prophet as to his place upon the great program of the age. The dream image had left an abiding impression upon his mind, Had not Daniel intimated that he, Nebuchadnezzar, was represented by the head of gold? Therefore, he desires to perpetuate that dream. He wanted to glorify himself and his kingdom, for the inference is plain that the image was of himself. The structure of the idol was immense. It was in the form of a man, 90 feet high and 9 feet broad. The purpose of its great size was, no doubt, that the people might be enabled to see it from a distance. Furthermore, it was set up in an open plain so that it could be seen from every direction without anything to obstruct the view. We may be sure there was method in all the king's madness. He wanted the worship of the people. God gave the man governmental power, but as always, he abused his privileges by setting up idolatry. Men want to see something, though it be only an image which their own hands have made, and they will fall down and worship it, proof of their degeneracy. After the Lord delivered Israel out of Egypt by his own stretched out arm, they made an image of a calf, no doubt with several heads, and said, as Jehovah informed Moses, "These be thy gods, O Israel, that have brought thee out of Egypt." Exodus 33:8. In the end of this age, when the Lord will have again brought them up into the land of Palestine by his own mighty power, they will make an image and give the glory of their deliverance to the man whom it represents. Note the similarity in some respects of the description of this last day image, as John gives it, with that of the image of Nebuchadnezzar, as here given by Daniel. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Revelation 13:18. The number 6 has a place of prominence in both instances. It is the number of man. His day and his perfection, or imperfection, as we might say, are thus signified. The Lord's day and its consummation are symbolized by the number 7. Man has 6 work days. The 7th day belongs to God. It is his day. After man has failed, he will take charge of affairs and finish his work. Nebuchadnezzar demands worship of his image, the refusal to be met with death. The beast demands the same absolute homage for his image. Nebuchadnezzar desires to unify his kingdom by the worship of the golden idol that he sets up, likewise the last king of the Gentiles. He desires but one religion in his realm, and that is the worship of himself. We read that he will lift up himself above all that is called God or is worshipped, so that he, as God, sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. 2 Thessalonians 2:4. There is no influence so potent as religion. Unity of worship generally brings unity of purpose and aim. It will do more to weld the heart of the world together than any other force in the end of the age. We see evidences of this unity today. What is the meaning of union religious meetings where the real power of God is denied? What else means the coming together of Masonry and Catholicism? The whole world will wonder after and worship the beast. He will be its God. Dedication of the image. Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and tongues, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye shall fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, at that time when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, All the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Daniel 3, verses 2 through 7. Though yet in its infancy, this very condition is present today. The national powers are in a semblance of coalition, while the churches are advocating unity continually. Both of these confederacies will be full-grown shortly and together launch a counterfeit millennium with its counterfeit king, the Antichrist. Observe that the heads over all the Chaldean Empire were called to the dedication of the image set up in the plain of Dura, which was near to the capital city of the kingdom. It is an official command, and none dare to disregard the order. Yet it appears that Daniel was not included in its sweeping edict. There is no mention of him, while his three friends, who had been set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, occupy the greater part of the stage in this third chapter. We believe that is not accidental, for we are not reading just ordinary history, but happenings which have prophetic value. In fact, Daniel 3 to Daniel 6 is wonderfully suggestive of future events that stand related to one another and which will follow immediately after the launching forth of the League of Nations upon the Gentile Sea. The feat phase of the Fourth World Empire, political Babylon, is figured by Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom in this third chapter. While his image of gold, to which all men must bow, is a shadow of religious Babylon, which will be linked up with political Babylon in the latter days. The three Hebrews. Wherefore at this time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, he shall be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Daniel 3, verses 8 through 12. We are impressed as we read the above inspired account with the stratagem of Nebuchadnezzar. He lays siege to the religious trend in the natural man by surrounding his false worship with everything that would attract him and appeal to his senses. Therefore, all kinds of music have the prominent place upon the platform and contribute to the startling effect of the scene. The emotions are mightily stirred by music. As someone has said, music hath charms to soothe the savage breast. Nebuchadnezzar was the first of whom we read to make use of the orchestra in religious things. It was this Babylonish king, moved no doubt by Satan, that had all kinds of music for his worldwide revival, and we should beware of his example. It is a snare to the people of God. How much of the Babylonish ways we see in the church these days, how much talk of big things, great revivals, startling effects, miracle men and women, wonderful sermons, marvelous music, etc., are heard on every hand. The stock of adjectives is almost exhausted to describe all the doings in religious circles, but we truly believe much of it is carnal and Babylonish, not spiritual or Christian. God never stirs the soulish, emotional man. He works through the spirit of man. That does not mean that such do not feel most wonderfully, but rather the opposite. They are beside themselves, but not about man, nor man's doings, but ecstatic with the glory of God. They are not filled with praises to man, but are filled with praises to God. In the beginning, the church was simple in her manner of worship. Paul had no brass bands, no opera stars, or any great well-known orchestras to draw the people or hold their interest. God was his only drawing card. Christ was the only great man that he preached, while the Holy Ghost created all the interest in his meetings and stirred all the emotion that was felt. The church is not taught to look for any great worldwide revival nor great unity of religions before Christ comes, and she is not to be swayed by Babylonish ways or methods which appeal to the flesh. Alas, how few there are that are free from Babylon. She still rules and reigns over the greater part of even God's free people, for to refuse to obey her dictates is to make oneself a prey to her ridicule, mockery, and later her fiery indignation. The three Hebrew boys were certainly in the limelight in this chapter. They occupy the center of the stage, for they are the only ones mentioned that dared to defy the king and absent themselves from that religious gathering. Even today, Babylon exerts a more potent spell over the minds and hearts of people than the word of the Lord. They are more afraid of disobeying her mandates and thereby incurring her displeasure and mockery than they are of disobeying God. Remember, Babylon's ways are diverse, and she is disguised in many wonderful, attractive phases. You may have her in any form that you desire. She delights in form and ceremony, but refuses everything of the supernatural and unseen. Her ways are manifest, and her worship is the style in almost every Christian gathering in the world. She may easily be identified if we walk in the light. Let us with anointed eyes learn not to bow to her gods, even if we are called upon the carpet of the world's court, as were those three sons of Judah. They protested against Babylon's rule over their consciences and refused to conform to her religion. Three charges were preferred against those protesting nonconformists. The first, "These men have not regarded thee," speaks of contempt for the king. The second, "They serve not thy gods," would signify a division, lack of unity, etc. However, the third charge, "Nor worship the golden image," is a step further and speaks of absolute rebellion against the government. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar's command to worship the image represented the fact that all the world must have one religion, and that religion was backed up by the power of the United World Empire. That was certainly an exhibition of daring. These three young men, defenseless as it were, refused to do as the world required and as the government demanded. That was the bravery of faith, an illustration of true consecration. They had already heard from heaven, receiving their order from a higher court. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do you not worship the golden image which I have set up? Now if ye be ready, that at what time ye hear the sound of the flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made, well, but if not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace, and who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" Daniel 3, verses 13 through 15. Nebuchadnezzar's orders had been disobeyed. His decree was held in contempt. Yet he is reluctant to destroy these sons of Judah. They are among the great men of his realm, and he, no doubt, remembers his dream and their association with Daniel, who interpreted it. So he grants them another opportunity to worship the golden image. Again, they refuse to bow their knees to Babylon's God. No power on earth, not all the combined strength of the world, is able to make them to break faith with Jehovah, the true and living God. They are not quaking with fear as they stand before the world's court, for their words prove that their spirit is undaunted, unafraid. They say, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thy hand, O king. But if not, Be it known unto thee, O King, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Daniel 3, verses 17 and 18. They need not time for deliberation as to their attitude to this false idol. Nebuchadnezzar's second chance makes no impression upon them. The king had really thrown down the gauntlet and challenged their God in these words to them, "Who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hand?" They could do no less than stand pat. Jehovah's honor was at stake in the matter. The king himself had shown that the issue was between the true God and the false idol. Jehovah himself must be given the opportunity of defending his own honor, faithfulness, and power. These three Hebrew boys were simply given the opportunity of letting God prove himself through them. The king knew the God he was defying. He was the God of Daniel, the very one that had given that marvelous dream to him and then gave the interpretation to the prophet. At that time, the king had acknowledged him as the supreme God, sovereign of the earth. Now he is actually disputing his claim to these three young men. There had come a decided change in Nebuchadnezzar. He is feeling his oats, as the saying is. In other words, he feels secure and independent. He is the king of the world, and he wants all men to know this fact and acknowledge his supremacy. In Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar was more humble, for he was not yet the master of the scene. The city of Jerusalem was yet standing, and the temple of Jehovah was not yet in ruins. He had not yet gotten complete control of the situation. The captivity of Judah was not yet consummated. It was only in partial effect. But now, at the time of the setting up of the idol, it was an accomplished fact. Therefore, his pride is in evidence here. He is taking to himself the honor and glory of all that God has done for him.